You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. Virginia History with Rick Britton starts right now. Rick Britton is a local award-winning author, cartographer, and historian. You can find him online at rickbritton.com. Rick joins me in studio for our continuing series on Virginia's colorful 18th and 19th century history. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing really well. Thank you. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Kind of chilly out there. It's only about 40 degrees, but it's the kind of chill that puts a nice spring in your step when you're out walking.
It sure does. I see you brought a clip along, a little audio clip along with you this morning. Would you like to set that up for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I brought a clip. We've got a series that took place down at the Senior Center that just terminated a couple of weeks ago. Virginia History 101, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, A Dynasty of Friends. And I gave a talk on James Monroe at the Battle of Trenton. And then I brought in a bunch of other speakers, Jeff Looney, the senior editor at the Papers of Thomas Jefferson Retirement Series, John Stagg, senior editor of the Papers of James Madison, Meg Kennedy from Montpelier, the home of James and Dolly Madison, Beth Taylor, who's an independent historian and scholar. And this clip is from our last speaker, and believe it or not, it's absolutely fifth president of the United States, James Monroe, speaking from his retirement. And of course, it's actor and historical interpreter extraordinaire Dennis Bigelow. And he's quite a character. You should see him in his pantaloons and in his black coat of black broadcloth with his tricorn hat, speaking to the crowd. And here he is speaking to the crowd at the Senior Center just recently.
Let's have a listen.
And some of the best years of my life were here in Charlottesville. My goodness, I was Virginia's first United States Senator living here in Charlottesville. And when I served under the Washington administration, which was not all happy, as I will tell you later on, my goodness, I was living here and serving as the first United States minister to the Republic of France. And, as some of you might remember, although you look all impossibly young to me, that in 1801, of course, when I was governor of Virginia, Charlottesville was incorporated as a full-fledged town. So, and I think I'm probably the only long-term resident, pardon me, of Charlottesville, to actually have been introduced to the woman for whom this town is named. We speak, of course, of Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg, Sophia of Mecklenburg. You know, people say such unkind things. You know, for years we used to say that Queen Charlotte never outgrew her ugliness. But I must tell you that I met the woman. Of course, I was introduced as our minister to London once I'd finished my business in Paris in 1803. And I found her quite comely, and obviously George III found her comely. She gave him more than 13 children, for goodness sakes.
Well, that's really something, isn't it?
Yeah, like I said, he's quite a character, and he's a great entertainer.
I thought it was kind of fun was I noticed that while he was waiting to come into the room, he was talking with some people as they were arriving, but he was in character the whole time.
Oh, yeah, he stays in character. Once he puts his getup on, he stays in character, and had a lot of fun introducing him. I got everybody to stand, and we brought him into the room to a great round of applause. He's a great guy.
That's great.
Yeah.
All right, so what are we going to talk about today?
Well, you know, one of the things I meant to get to last time, and I give battlefield tours, Civil War battlefield tours, pretty often, at least once a month, once the season gets nice. And there's one question that I wanted us to talk about that I get a lot. And people see movies, people see the TV shows about the Civil War, and they see reenactors doing these things out at the reenactments. And they ask me really often, I get this just about every time, did they really, in battle, march shoulder to shoulder, and did they really fight that way? And if they, and if they did, why? Why did they fight that way? I mean, isn't that crazy? Isn't that what caused the horrendous casualties in the Civil War? And the answer really, surprisingly, is pretty much yes. Now, when you see reenactors out at a Civil War reenactment doing it, they're doing pretty much what the parade ground drill looked like. And the Civil War soldier, North and South, drilled even on campaign as much as possible every single day. So they learned to do this on the parade ground. When they got out on the battlefield, of course, things changed pretty quickly. Of course, there's that famous saying, nothing ever, no battlefield plan and no battlefield formation ever survived the proximity of the enemy. So things get broken up, but as much as possible, they're trying to do it shoulder to shoulder, just like you see in those lithographs, just like you see in those images. Of course, as they take casualties, that formation gets broken up. And of course, there's a lot of smoke and a lot of noise and a lot of screaming from the officers and by the men killed and wounded. But they're trying to maintain that shoulder to shoulder. Then the question is, well, why? Why would they do that? Why would they march like that? And didn't that cause the horrific casualties? And of course, that did cause the horrific casualties. We talked earlier in one of the earlier episodes about how we think now that the losses in the Civil War were 850,000 instead of 620,000. And the answers are pretty simple when you think about it. By and large, they're firing weapons that you can load and fire if you're really quick, three times a minute. So compared to modern day firepower, that's very slow. That's a very slow rate of fire compared to somebody with a semi-automatic or an automatic weapon. And this is before the days of walkie-talkies, before the days of radio. So the basic answer is command control. The colonels in command of the regiments, the generals in command of their brigades, they have to keep their men in the range of their voices or whatever else they're using to transmit the commands. So it's either voice command being repeated by the captains and the sergeants in the ranks, or a command that's being issued by a bugle, or a command that's being issued by a drum. So the men have to stay within the sound of those commands one way or another in order to stay together, in order to maintain their unity. Why do they want to maintain their unity? Why do they want to maintain that line of battle where they're firing shoulder to shoulder? And the answer is really simple. The entire basis of the combat back then, infantry combat, most of the combat, was these massed volleys. And massed volleys put a volume of lead out in the direction of the enemy. And I say that because oftentimes they're not even seeing the enemy. They're firing at the muzzle flashes of the enemy, or they're firing in the direction of the smoke from the muzzle flashes of the enemy. So the whole idea is to put volley fire out. Now, oftentimes when I describe this to people, they go, well, why don't they spread out? And men on a skirmish line are spread out, 6, 8, 10 paces apart. But a skirmish line is almost just like a little fence. It's just like a little feeler out in front of your line. And the idea is not to stop any group of people. A defensive line that's only made up of skirmishers where they're 6, 8, 10 paces apart, that can't withstand an attack by a large group of men coming shoulder to shoulder. Just like the amount of firepower put out by a skirmish line is not going to stop and is not going to equal in any measure the amount of fire put out by a line of battle of men shoulder to shoulder firing out that sheet of lead.
Now you mentioned that, of course, they didn't have radio or modern communications then. So did they use any kind of a form of relay? I mean, did commanders relay to subcommanders eventually down the line? Or
they did. So they're shouting out commands, and then a colonel is shouting out a command to his regiment, and the captains and the sergeants are repeating that behind the lines. But then a general, to stay in touch with the different colonels under his command, he's oftentimes sending out couriers, mounted couriers, or he's often sending out runners behind the line of battle to transmit the commands. And of course, lots of times those things, they're trying to coordinate an assault, they're trying to coordinate a retreat. Lots of times those things get completely bollocksed in the confusion of battle. But that's pretty much what I wanted to tell everybody about firing, about fighting shoulder to shoulder. The idea is to put out this massed fire. When you think about it, in modern combat, in 20th and 21st century combat, the weapons became semi-automatic and automatic, where they're putting out a lot more fire, and it's that volume of fire that allowed men on the battle line to be spread further apart with machine guns, because one man or a small group of men manning a machine gun can put out the equivalent firepower of 100, 150, 200 men in a Civil War battle line. So it's that volume of fire in advanced combat in, with advanced weapons that allowed the battle line to be spread apart.
So would it be fair to say then that the tremendous number of casualties of the Civil War were in part due to when it occurred in history? If it had been 50 years earlier, we wouldn't have had the gun power, and it would have been 50 years later, we would have been more like what you just described.
That's true. That's true, except that if it occurred 50 years earlier, they're using the Napoleonic tactics, so more than likely the casualties would have been just as horrendous 50 years earlier. Yeah, absolutely. So the next thing we wanted to talk about was marching. And to get the men to the battlefield on campaign, they're marching. So how did they march? Well, the standard formation in marching was a column of fours. So let's take, for example, a regiment, a pretty good-sized regiment mid-war, about 800 men. Actually, that's a very large regiment mid-war. A column of fours means that across the front of the marching column, there are four men, four abreast, a column of fours. So that means they are 200 men deep. And as they set off on the march, and lots of times they're marching, they start off marching by the drum. The men might be singing. We'll talk about this a little bit later. As they set off on the march, that column of fours kind of spreads out so that each group of fours might be a yard apart. So think about this 800-man unit might be taking up 200 yards of road because they're four abreast times 200. It's easy to see when you think about this logistically, when you think about this numbers-wise, it's easy to see how a brigade with several thousand men, how a division with 5, 7, 10,000 men, how a corps with 15, 20,000 men, with the artillery, with the supply wagons, with the ambulances, and then how the units stretch out, get attenuated. All of a sudden, an army is taking up miles and miles and miles of road. And that's one of the reasons that what you'd want to do as a good planner, as a good strategic planner, is to stretch out your army and place it on several roads, hopefully several roads going on a parallel track or ending up joining at some point. Putting your army on one road and having it stretch out for 20 miles, 30 miles on one road, not a really good idea. The guys in the front are going to get someplace, and then it's going to be hours later when the guys in the back arrive there. That's why a lot of battles, when there are situations like that, where one army is marching along one road or one main road, they're going to fight what's called a meeting battle because it's going to take forever. It's going to take hours for the rest of that army to arrive. And so that's what's called a meeting engagement. Average marching time that a man walks is about 2.5 miles an hour. And lots of times what the officers would do is they would follow the book, and believe it or not, there are actually manuals on how to do this, how to go on the march. So they would be walking at about 2.5 miles an hour. 50 minutes, this is by the book, by the manual in use at the time, 50 minutes they'd be marching every hour, and then 10 minutes they'd be resting. So they'd start off early in the morning at 8 o'clock or earlier if they had to get someplace really quick. Of course, they would take a break for lunch. They would take those 10 minutes breaks, and it would be handled almost like a job. They'd march about 8 hours. Sometimes you'd push your men further, you'd march them for 10 hours, but you got to be careful. You don't want to wear them out because you might be going someplace and then fighting a battle. So you don't want to completely wear out your guys before they get someplace, and then they have to exert themselves even more. So you can see marching 2.5 miles an hour 10-minute breaks every hour, an hour for lunch. You march 8 hours in a day, and you're going to go about 15 or 16 miles. And that was about an average for an army. But then, of course, you can go faster. I know I've timed myself. I can do 4 miles an hour. Even at this age, I can do 4 miles an hour. But I can't do that over an extended period. Younger guys in the Army, 25, 20 years old, they can do 4 miles an hour for an extended time. That'd be called force marching. And that's how you get some of these amazing marches where people like Stonewall Jackson, commanding his army in the Valley, sometimes in a day, over the course of a day, he's giving them breaks, but they could do 40 miles. Over the course of 2 days, they could be 50 miles. And that's how he was able to pull off some of those amazing surprise attacks. The enemy wouldn't even imagine that he could be getting there, and there he is.
And so is marching the most common way that, that armies were moved? I mean, I know there was some movement of troops by railway and by the with ironclads, but was marching still the most common way to get
absolutely
an army from point A to point B?
Absolutely, either by marching, by using the railroad, and that was used quite a bit, especially out west where the distances are huge, and then by troop transports up and down the coast. And of course, when I'm talking about troop transports, I'm mostly talking about the Union Army being transported by Union naval vessels and Union naval troop transports. But those are the most common methods of transporting somebody. You can imagine, as the day wears on, as they're marching hour after hour, even though they're getting those breaks, every time they'd get those breaks, you'd always see the coffee addicts would fall out. And even though they only know that they've got 10 minutes, they're going to start this little fire. They're going to put this tin cup on top of this little fire. They're going to sprinkle the coffee they've got inside. They're going to boil some water just to get one cup. That was really common. You'd see these guys gather around these little tiny campfires, even though they know they've only got 10 minutes. They need that extra burst of energy that they're going to get from that caffeine. But you could see how on a long day, hour after hour drags by, all the dust being kicked up by all the guys in front of you, and heaven forbid that you'd be at the end of a long column where the dust is the worst. And then, of course, there's all the excrement that's being dumped on the road by the animals who are ahead of you. So it gets really nasty and gets really tiring. So a lot of the equipment, you start moving it around. Your uniform bunches up, so you open it up. Your gun, your weapon, weighing about 9 pounds, a Springfield or an Enfield weighing about 9 pounds, it gets really cumbersome. So you start carrying it different ways. Eventually, maybe you sling it over your back using the gun sling. But that thing gets really cumbersome. All of the things around your waist, the cartridge box, the cap box, the haversack, the canteen, very precious there with that water that you're going to be sipping at a lot on this long march. Those things, you start shuffling them around. And then everything, like we talked about, everything that you think weighs too much that you don't think you're going to need that night or that very day, you're going to start tossing off. So it was really common. Guys coming along behind an army on the march with wagons could pick up all kinds of items that the men in front of them had dumped on the side of the road.
So it's an automatic cleanup sort of thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And did men just drop off either from exhaustion or go AWOL during these long marches? Ever?
Yeah, absolutely. And they'd wait for an officer to be looking in another direction, and they'd head off into the woods, straggling. Sometimes, of course, the shoes were so bad that the feet would bleed. They'd take off the shoes. They'd walk with their bloody feet. Sometimes it's better to walk barefoot if the road's good enough than to even wear your shoes because, you know, after going for a few months barefoot, you get those hard calluses on the bottom of your feet, and they're better, of course, than any shoes in the summertime. But yeah, lots of times the roadside would be littered with stragglers, and usually an army would have some wagons following in its wake, picking up that equipment, but also picking up the stragglers and giving them a ride into camp.
Amazing. As always, Rick, amazing. Okay. So now a couple of things before we let you go. I wanted to, and I think we might have missed this at the beginning, that the Virginia History Sorry, which is the series 201?
Virginia History 201, right?
Right. The Virginia History 201, which we heard a short clip from the final lecture earlier in this podcast.
Right.
Will be the Charlottesville Podcasting Network will be running that whole series. We'll be airing that whole series starting Thursday, November 3rd, and continuing for five lectures in that series, mm-hmm. right? For five consecutive Thursdays following that. So if our listeners want to come back and join in on that. And it's a great series, by the way.
Oh, yeah. There's some really, really good lectures, including one on Dolly Madison, one on slavery at Monticello and Montpelier, Jefferson and Madison's homes. There's some great talks.
Some great talks. And you'll be back on November 13th for the next episode in this series, and we're going to have kind of a special treat. We're going to be talking to you live from the fields of Gettysburg.
That's right. That's right. I'm taking a bus group up there, and I'm going to call in, and you're going to record it.
That's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We'll see you then.
All right. Take care.
Join us each second and fourth Sunday for Virginia History with Rick Britton. For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.